Welcome to the Skeptic's Guide to Emergency Medicine. Meet him, greet him, treat him, and street him. Today's date is April 24th, 2020, and I am your skeptical host, Ken Milne. The title of today's podcast is, Who's Gonna Drive You to the ED? With lights and sirens? And our guest skeptic is Dr. Robert Edmonds. He is an emergency physician in the U.S. Air Force in Virginia. This is Bob's, not 8th, not 9th, not 10th, but my second favorite number, 11th visit to the SGEM. Welcome back to the SGEM, Bob.
Thanks, Ken. Hope you're ready to crank it to 11.
Oh, we're going to 11 today with lights and sirens. But you need to get your disclaimer out of the way first.
As always, the views and opinions of this podcast do not represent the United States government or the U.S. Air Force.
Good. Out of the way. So, how you doing? I hear you're moving soon.
Yeah. Provided everything COVID doesn't go crazy, we are supposed to go to Ohio this summer and start a new career there in a non-clinical job.
Wow. Life of a military family, moving from city to city.
Yeah, it's something else, especially when you're trying to buy a house without being able to see it in person, but it is what it is.
It is what it is. All right, let's get on to this exciting 11th episode with lights and sirens and give us a case.
All right, so you're visiting with your father, a 64-year-old overweight man with hypertension. He describes significant pain in his chest upon awakening and tells you to call an ambulance. The EMS crew arrives, performs a 3-lead EKG that does not show an ST-elevated myocardial infarction. They prepare to load your father into the ambulance, and since you're his only child and he's a talker, he mentions you're an emergency physician. The crew then asks if you want them to transport your father code 3 with full lights and sirens.
Well, the use of warning lights and sirens in ambulances is fairly widespread. Their use is associated with marginally faster response and transport times.
That's right. Several studies have found ambulance crashes occurring while lights and sirens are used to have a higher injury rate, and a majority of fatal ambulance crashes involve their use.
EMS agencies have varying guidelines on when to use lights and sirens, and the amount of time saved with lights and sirens is about 1 to 3 minutes. This means the intervention is likely unhelpful for a patient-oriented outcome in most transports. All right, let's get to the clinical question.
What is the association between warning lights and sirens used by EMS and crash-related delays?
And the reference?
Yeah, so it's Watanabe et al. Is use of warning lights and sirens associated with increased risk of ambulance crashes, a contemporary analysis using National EMS Information System data in the Annals of Emergency Medicine, July 2019.
All right, let's run through the PICO. What was the population?
All dispatches of a transport-capable ground EMS vehicle to a 911 emergency scene from the 2016 National EMS Information System, both the response to the scene and the transport from the scene.
And there was a number of exclusions, and I'll list those in the show notes. What was the intervention?
Use of lights and sirens.
And the comparison?
No lights and sirens.
And what was their outcome?
Crash-related delay, which was used as a proxy for an EMS vehicle crash.
The author's conclusions were, quote, ambulance use of lights and sirens is associated with increased risk of ambulance crashes. The association is greatest during the transport phase. EMS providers should weigh these risks against any potential time saving associated with lights and siren use. All right, let's run through the quality checklist for observational studies, and there's 11. So the first question. Did the study address a clearly focused issue?
Yes.
Did the authors use an appropriate method to answer their question?
Yes, as an RCT would be unfeasible, and the amount of data needed to fully power a study of this sort probably mandates usage of a large data set.
Was the cohort recruited in an acceptable way?
Yes.
Was the exposure accurately measured to minimize bias?
Yes, they included separate categories as well for partial versus full use of lights and sirens.
And was the outcome accurately measured to minimize bias?
Yes and no. Using crash-related delays as a proxy for crashes had a chance to miss some crashes that did not result in delays.
Have the authors identified all important confounding factors?
I think so.
Was the follow-up of subjects complete enough?
Yes.
How precise do you think the results are?
I think it's adequate.
Okay, do you believe the results?
Yeah.
Now, can the results be applied to the local population?
For me, yes, in America. For you, it's unclear.
Ah, external validity. Okay, the final question, number 11. Do the results of this study fit with other available evidence?
Yes.
Now, the results section isn't going to be big here, so let's go through the key results. The 2016 NEMSIS database contained 20.4 million 911 dispatches of ground EMS. There was a total of just over 2,500 crash-related delays. What was the big outcome from this study?
There was a greater odds ratio of crashing with the use of lights and sirens.
Yeah, and I'll put in a table in the show notes showing the difference between response phase and the transport phase with regards to adjusted odds ratios. And the adjusted odds ratio was greater for the transport phase, 2.9, versus the response phase of 1.5. But let's get to talking nerdy. That's got to be my favorite part. And you've got the first point.
All right, so reporting bias. The authors mentioned how the study is entirely dependent on crash-related delays. It's unknown how widespread reporting of crash-related delays is, and since this is dependent on individual agencies' self-reporting, there may be bias from the agencies to report this more commonly when lights and sirens are used, as this was already believed at the time of the study, to induce additional risk. Alternatively, as the authors point out, some upgrades to lights and sirens may occur after an ambulance crash has occurred, which would also bias the results.
I'm going to ease into the nerdiness with point number two, and this is association, not causation. It would not be correct to conclude that lights and sirens necessarily cause crashes. This was a retrospective database study and not a randomized control trial. There could have been unmeasured confounders responsible for the observed results.
So number three, partial lights and sirens. The authors teased apart three scenarios: complete absence of lights and sirens, full use of lights and sirens, and partial use of lights and sirens. These partial use cases include both cases where there was initially no lights and sirens, and then they upgraded, as well as cases where the crews started with lights and sirens, and they downgraded, turning everything off. Due to the retrospective nature of the study, it's not possible to discern, at a systematic level, how these upgrade and downgrade situations are determined, and if there is a theme to these which would impact the results.
All right, number four is my much meatier one, and this is about something called the Peltzman effect. This is a theory that proposes people will be more likely to engage in risky behavior when safety measures have been introduced. This change in behavior will compensate for any benefit achieved by the intervention. It was named after Sam Peltzman, who in the 1970s hypothesized that mandating seatbelts in cars would increase risky behavior and result in more crashes and injuries. Now, his proposal was controversial at the time, and the data from seatbelts ultimately demonstrated that they did have a net benefit. However, there are a number of examples of the Peltzman effect that did not have a net benefit. Now, in medicine, there can be unintended consequences of healthcare interventions. Some examples include smoking cessation, electronic medical records, rapid response teams, and others. When an intervention is introduced, it can nudge behavior of the physician and/or the patient, resulting in a compensatory response that may have a net negative impact. And there's a great paper on this by Prasad and Jenna from 2014, and I'll include that link in the show notes. But in this case, lights and siren use by EMS may give the paramedics a false sense of security, and they may drive more aggressively, and that results in greater number of crashes.
Bringing it home with number five, lack of patient-oriented outcomes. Although the direct comparison of lights and sirens and crashes is important, it would have been interesting if data could be collected on patient-important outcomes, such as mortality, injuries to the patients or EMS crews, or duration of delays.
All right, it's time to comment on the author's conclusions and compare them to the SGEM's conclusions.
We agree with the authors that there is an associated increase in crashes with the use of lights and sirens, but this appears to be much less statistically compelling in the response phase.
And how about an SGEM bottom line?
The use of warning lights and sirens significantly increases the risk of crash in the transport phase.
And how about a case resolution?
You tell the EMS crew to use their best judgment. They drive to the nearest emergency room without the use of lights and sirens. Your father is diagnosed with a pulmonary embolism and convalesces in the hospital for a few days until he is uneventfully discharged home on a Pixaban.
And how about the clinical application?
For clinicians involved in the decision regarding EMS utilization, this study further focuses on the need for judicious use of lights and sirens. As noted in the accompanying editorial by Tanaka in the same issue of Annals, the fire department of the city of New York estimated a 32% reduction in crashes during their test period with updated lights and sirens protocol. 32%, Ken.
Is that relative or absolute?
I would have to actually look at that. I'm not sure. Yeah.
I bet you it's relative, but I don't know because we don't want to oversell it.
Either way, I mean, I would say that's pretty good. When this is coupled with a fairly minor reduction in transport time of only 1 to 3 minutes with the use of lights and sirens, it makes a strong case to limit the use of lights and sirens for only the patients with the most dire need for timely emergency medical care.
And so what are you going to tell the patient? But this isn't going to be the patient, isn't it? It's going to be the ambulance crew.
The ambulance crew will make a choice about whether it's appropriate to use lights and sirens to transport you to the hospital. Even if they don't go with lights and sirens, they're still going to get you to the hospital quickly, and there's less risk of crashing.
It's time for the Keener contest, and last week's winner was a repeat win for Jonathan Godfrey, a paramedic from Asheville, North Carolina. He knew the name of Boyle's publication in 1661 that bears directly on the SGEM is, quote, The Skeptical Chemist, A Chemico-Physical Doubts and Paradoxes. What's the question this week?
On average, how long does it take EMS to arrive after calling 911 in America?
Well, if you know the answer to this American question, then send an email to thesgem at gmail.com with Keener in the subject line. The first correct answer will receive a cool skeptical prize. Well, thanks, Robert, for coming back on the SGEM during these busy COVID times.
Absolutely. Happy to do it. Anything to keep us sharp while we're still dealing with the pandemic and think about other things is good.
Well, it's nice. Then we don't have the blinders on, and hopefully we can protect against making anchoring errors, thinking that everything that presents is going to be COVID-19. We still need to keep our differentials open and think of, you know, the usual stuff that we see in the emergency department.
Absolutely.
But I'm looking forward to you moving to Ohio because that's going to be closer to me. And then we could actually meet up and do number 12 in person. I'm saying it here first. You're hearing it first. Number 12, we need to do it face to face.
All right. I like it. We can even try to make it something themed on the Wright brothers. They're based out of Dayton, Ohio.
All right, you know the last thing to do. Give that SGEM tagline.
Remember to be skeptical of anything you learn, even if you heard it on The Skeptic's Guide to Emergency Medicine.
Talk to everyone next time. Who's gonna drive you home?